Welcome to yet another episode of When a Guy Has a Really Fucked Gender. As always, I'm your host, Jolene, and I'm joined this week by Megan. Megan, would you like to say hello to the audience?
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me, Jolene.
Yes, I'm thrilled. Megan, how would you describe your gender?
It's not an easy question to answer. What I've kind of landed on currently is that I am perceived and treated like a woman by society. So that is not wrong, but I don't really very strongly internally identify with one. And that's just kind of where I'm at currently.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Not at all an uncommon sentiment. We're here today to talk about, I guess, your job. What's your job?
Yeah, well, I guess I would describe I'm a neuroscientist and neuroendocrinologist, and my day job is I'm a professor at Emory University, teaching in the neuroscience and behavioral biology department.
Yeah, and that all is so fascinating. I'm so excited to talk to you about that because I think that this is a, you know, obviously, right, this show's purview is trans people, transitions, not a sort of universal factor of that experience, but a very common one is hormones, and hormones get talked about with sex, sexuality, all those sorts of things so much. And there's obviously a sort of a lot of sort of, I guess we could say, sexed behavior gets kind of naturalized through hormones, both kind of, you know, scientifically and also just kind of in folk understandings of biology, I guess, if that's a sort of concept we can run with.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
So, yeah, is we'll talk about that.
Okay. Do you want me to, I can just ramble, or do you have like a certain direction you want to shove me in?
Well, I guess I was going to, I had some kind of, some vague directionality we can go with.
Okay.
So what is a hormone?
Well, so the definition of like a hormone biologically is, originally, I'm going to use this as a loose term, but it's originally a hormone that travels through the bloodstream, a molecule that travels through the bloodstream to affect target tissues that are far away or in a different location than where the hormone was produced and where the molecule was produced, right? So there are different types of hormones in the body, right? So there's steroid hormones, of which I'm sure many of our listeners will know, like estrogens and androgens and progestogens, right? Even glucocorticoids are part of that kind of area. So stress hormones as well. But there are also other hormones that our body use quite regularly that are protein hormones, peptide hormones. So things like insulin is another type of hormone. So hormones are actually just like a big class of molecules that, when they were discovered, went through the bloodstream to do their job. But nowadays, we also know that most molecules do double duty. And so there are hormones that in one context will travel through the bloodstream and go from the gonads to the brain, for instance. But in another case, that same exact molecule doesn't travel through the bloodstream and instead is locally produced and used.
I didn't actually know that was the sort of the definition of a hormone. I outing myself as somewhat of a, right, I do have a chemistry background, but I'm really, really bad at biology. But that's actually really fascinating, because that is one of the things that I do understand about biology and sort of, I guess, the kind of social existence of all this stuff is that so many of these molecules get sort of like treated as like kind of essential. But what you said in there about molecules, you know, sort of pulling double duty or pulling multiple duties is, I think, so important for thinking about this sort of stuff because it is all about their sort of place within a biological system or something like that, right? The that it's not like any of these things are just kind of like you put them into any kind of, you know, system, they're going to have a kind of consistent effect. A lot of it is dependent upon, you know, there being receptors, upon those receptors, you know, working in a particular way, right? There can be sort of all kinds of distinctions.
Yeah, absolutely. Hormones are 100% contextual. You know, like you said, if you have the hormone but no receptor, like, what the hell are you going to do, right? You're not going to detect that hormone, and, like, that's okay. Yeah, and so the ways, there are some consistent ways that some hormones do act, but I will say that most of the time there is definitely an element of, have you been exposed to that hormone before? Or what has your life experience been?
Right. Okay, so that's interesting. I didn't know about the sort of sensitization. I mean, I suppose that makes sense. I guess that, right, we're talking about this super, super broad class of chemicals within a body. So, of course, there's, you know, many that are, the sensitization is going to be an effect in terms of how they get taken up in the body and what all they do.
Yeah, absolutely. And it can go, depending on the hormone and depending on the system, it could go either way. It could sensitize. It could also desensitize, right? Like, there's just so many things that kind of go into hormone action that it's kind of one of my favorite things about hormones, and particularly like the steroid hormones and gonadal hormones, because it's just so messy. There's just so much to uncover.
And when you say gonadal hormones, are those, do you mean the sex hormones, or is that a distinct?
Yeah, so you know, that's a funny, I tend to stay away personally, this is a me thing, not like a field thing. I personally tend to stay away from the designation of sex hormones, because, like, I don't know, it gives credence to this idea that they are inherently sexed, in a way, and we are not the ones that are doing the sexing of the hormones. But I guess, like, I consider gonadal hormones just like hormones that come from the gonads. So generally that is like estrogens, androgens, and progestogens. But that doesn't mean that those hormones can't come from other places.
Right. It's very complicated. I'm, you know, aware of, right. Is it the adrenals also produce some measure of some amount of androgens and estrogens and progesterone?
Yeah. So I would say that, at least to my knowledge, the adrenals mostly are well known for pumping out glucocorticoids, right? So, like, cortisol in humans or corticosterone in some animals. But there's also a great deal of androgens that come from the adrenals. Because if you kind of look at, like, the synthesis pathway before both glucocorticoids and androgens, you need to have progesterone, some type of progestogen. And so if there's too much progesterone, for instance, being made, and not all of it is being made quickly enough into corticosterone or cortisol, depending on your system, it might shunt it to the other pathway, which is androgens.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
What is the, so, right, this is so, I'm in a very sort of awkward position in terms of my knowledge base with respect to this, I feel, because I know that you obviously know so much about all this stuff. You live and breathe it. Maybe not live and breathe it. It's your job. but I also, you know that a lot of the kind of, you know, I think I said folk biology earlier. We're going to keep using that term, I guess, because it's useful. Around the gonadal hormones, you know, the androgens, the estrogens, I guess people usually right just say testosterone or estrogen, which are, you know, obviously testosterone is not the only androgen. Estrogen, there's like a billion different forms.
Yep.
So right, people sort of like, there's the kind of like very basic level, like testosterone is the man hormone, estrogen is the woman hormone, right?
And I don't think that, like, just want to interject real quick to be like, to kind of recognize that the, what you're calling like the folk knowledge of these hormones, right? I don't necessarily think is that out of line with the way that we continue to view these hormones, unless you do live and breathe them.
Right.
You know, one of the reasons that you reached out to me was like a paper that I had written that is kind of pushing back against this idea that even though as scientists, you know, I could tell you, yeah, testosterone gets converted into estradiol, and everybody has every person on this planet, probably maybe with some exceptions, has some level of all of the different hormones, right? But we still treat, even in science, like the same way that we talk about them, right? Testosterone is male and estrogen is female. Estradiol is female. And even if we know better, like if you just look at our experiments, that's how we're treating it.
Yeah, that was a really fascinating aspect of the paper, which I'll put a link to it in the description. I also acknowledge the other authors on it, Krishagi and MJ Hill. And we can talk a little bit more about the paper later, because there's some stuff in it that I thought was, that I didn't know about, that, I mean, I wouldn't have any reason to really know about, because it's about like experiment design and NIH funding, which I was very interested to learn about, but I don't live in that sort of world, so why would I know anything about it? And I should say, when I talk about folk biology, I don't mean to sort of like slice off that, you know, I've been around, you know, my share of scientists. I understand that even if they are very knowledgeable about these things, they are also still subject to all the kind of greater discourses and what have you. We have the sort of, you know, testosterone is male, estrogen is female. If you, you know, sort of know a little bit more, you might know, oh, well, it's not, you know, actually about the presence of the hormones. It's about their, you know, relative proportions, or what have you. But, right, you're also sort of, it kind of runs up against the kinds of, the ways that people think about sex generally, right? That people think sex is like a way more coherent variable than it really is, right? People sort of think about, almost like there's, you know, two, like, I think at one point I said, people seem to think that there's like a little sex ball in your body. And if you have the blue sex ball, you're a boy. And if you have the pink sex ball, you're a girl. And that just sort of like orders everything about your body in this, you know, sort of way that's completely distinct from one another. And I'm being, you know, maybe a little bit hyperbolic, but that does seem to be the way that people talk about sex sometimes. That seems to be what they're talking about. And this is actually something I have no sort of idea. And so I'm curious what the answer is. Do you know, is there a sort of, do we observe differences in the relative ratios of like androgens or estrogens produced by the adrenal based on different,
based on
any sort of criterion, or are they sort of just pumping it out at whatever rate?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I am not as well versed on the adrenals as I should be. If I had to make an educated guess, the educated guess would be that in general, the adrenals are fairly like for lack of a better way of phrasing it, like sex neutral. And it's really the differentiating factor in a lot of cases is the quantities of hormones that the gonads, which are usually either ovaries or testes, produce. I also, you know, while you were talking, I was thinking a lot about, like, you know, the reasons why we talk about, like, these, as you say, which I love, actually, the ball of blue and the ball of pink, like, inside these people that, like, organize the whole body, right? And because there are historical reasons for that, right? Like, they're, you know, back in the Victorian-esque and slightly pre-Victorian age, like, there was one sex. And, like, yeah, we had women and men in society, but biology didn't matter enough to for us to care that there it was just one sex. And, like, you know, women had male female testicles is what they called ovaries at that time, right? But then as science started to gain prominence and we needed to justify these structures in society, right, that's when we started saying, no, this is a two-sex model. And I can provide you with a link, or not a link, but like a citation. It's a really good, really old, quite old book at this point called Making Sex by, I think his name is Thomas Lacker, which kind of delineates this history, right? And so it's unsurprising to me that we're still in this frame of mind of there are two sexes and they like map on to these gender roles that we have, that we've established. And the discovery of like hormones helped make that even more salient, right? Because then they became like the biology of masculinity and femininity in a way.
Right. They become a sort of chemical, like a sort of chemical marker of this thing, a way that you could say like, oh, you know, I could identify the sex of this person based off of like a blood sample or something like that. Or they become, you know, a sort of like mechanistic explanation mm-hmm. for sex differences, right? You know, we see this all the time, sort of set out into behavioral sorts of mm-hmm. explanations, which, you know, people will say like, oh, you know, if a man's being very aggressive, they might say like, oh, he's got so much testosterone, you know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or people will blame literally like anything about a woman on, you know, the sort of hormonal variance that's, you know, mm-hmm. follows the menstruation cycle or, you know, I mean, among trans people all the time, we're blaming all sorts of things on forgetting our shots or I do that all the time.
Well, that's also like, I just want to also put out there, that's not to say these hormones don't have real effects. Right?
Oh, no, absolutely.
They absolutely do. It's just whether like these actions become coded as sexed, right?
Well, I think
is the point, right?
Right. Well, I think it's both that, and then I guess part of this is I genuinely don't know, so I'm curious, like, what degree, right? Because I assume that sometimes this is functioning as a sort of like just so explanation, sort of like socially, or a right, the sort of I guess I don't know kind of what the behavioral extension of sex hormones is, and so that's really mm-hmm. one of the things I kind of wanted to ask you about was how well do these hormones affect behavior, because I don't know.
The century, right? It's things we're still looking at that, right? Now I could very, very clearly explain to you how hormones affect behavior in like zebra finches and goldfish and mice and rats and a bunch of different fish, like plain-fed midshipmen and all this stuff. And usually when we study those things in the lab, we're studying them in relation to sexual behavior, which has always been a very interesting scenario for me, right? Because then what does that do? That like wraps up sexuality and our definition of sex in like very interesting ways. But when it comes to humans, we are a lot more complex creatures, right? Like no one is going to argue that if someone's pregnant in their third trimester and they're just like having all these mood swings, that that's not at least partially due to the effects of hormones. Now, is it due to the effect of the hormone being there? Is it due to the effect of it being higher than usual? Is it due to the effect of it swinging back and forth, right? Those still are questions, I think, that in some cases are answered and in some cases are not, right? But one of the things that like always really sticks with me about hormones is that I tend personally to take like a non-deterministic view of hormones, and it comes from this study I don't remember if it was mice or rats. I want to say rats because it was an old study, and usually those were done in rats, right? And so again, like I say, these hormones have been typically linked when we're talking about behavior in animals to sexual behavior. And so this really elegant study was looking at androgens, specifically testosterone, in relation to mounting behavior. So mounting is when, I mean, it is what it sounds like, right? It's like when a mouse like mounts another mouse on their back or rat in order for the copulation to happen. And so, and I think they did this with, now I'm wondering if I'm misciting the study, if this was with aggression or if this was with mounting. What I'll do is after this, I'll like find the citation and send it to you. But the moral of the story is the same either way, right? They segregate the animals into like high, low, medium, and low behavior, right? And they're like, okay, these animals do a lot of the behavior. These animals do a little bit, a medium amount. These animals do a low amount. And then they castrate them. They take away the testes. These are animals that have testes originally. And they see all of that behavior go away. Completely. Okay. So that what that shows first off is that testosterone is necessary for this behavior to occur. Like you have to have some of it. Okay. But the more interesting thing happened when they replaced it. So now what they did was they replaced all of these animals' testosterone with the same level of testosterone. So it's not like one had higher than the other because, you know, testes pump out different levels depending on the different person or different animal, right? They all have the same level. And the interesting thing was that the high behaviors were high behaving again. The medium behaviors were medium behaving again. The low behaviors were low behaving again. And what that indicates is that it's not actually the level of testosterone that's doing this. Something else is indicating to these animals whether they're going to be high behaviors or low behaviors. But you still need testosterone to like be there for that behavior to happen. Right. And so like, you know, that's a very elegant study in one scenario, right? So people are going to argue that's in one like specific scenario in like rodents, right? But to me, it makes a lot of sense with the amount of variability that we have walking in the world, that like these hormones might be necessary and they can tune different behaviors differently. But it's not like if I just give you a shot of X hormone and I give someone else a shot of the same X hormone that you're going to have the exact same behavioral response. Right? That's the point.
Right.
You might have like an increased, like both of you might have now an increased likelihood of crying or not crying or punching a wall or being, I don't know, tired all the time, right? Or not tired all the time, right? But it's not the only thing that's determining that output.
Okay. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. It is super fascinating. I hadn't heard of that study, but that's so interesting. And tracks so much.
Right. Yeah. Because hormones do a lot.
Right.
And
yeah.
Can you imagine if like everybody, we could just neutralize everybody by taking away a hormone or giving a certain hormone? Like that doesn't work.
Yeah.
It's more complicated than that.
Right. You know, I mean, like you see sort of, right. It's so interesting. I mean, yeah, like I said, this is, you know, sort of, I'm always going to be thinking, in the kind of, about sort of, I guess, analogies with trans people. And I mean, right, the mm-hmm. obvious sort of one that you see here is people talk all the time about the way that HRT affects their sex drives. Right, you see sort of with trans women, you see sort of like talk about, I mean, I guess you have like, right, the decline or sort of disappearing of spontaneous erections or decreased sex drive that then increases later, or you know, there's progesterone is there's sort of a lot of different positions on whether trans women should be supplementing progesterone in, or if they are supplementing it, how they should be. And the sort of relationship between progesterone and sex drive and all sorts of things.
And I mean, that's like unsurprising to me, right? Like cis women who have been taking birth control have been complaining about altered sex drive since the beginning of hormonal birth control, right, which is also a form of HRT in a way, right? Or hormone therapy, let's just call it, right? Yeah, and like for someone like me, who I'm aro ace, somewhere on that spectrum at least, right? Like that's always very interesting to me as well, of like this idea that like the way that we can honor the fact that yes, hormones, birth control, HRT, like all like, you know, postmenopausal treatment, like alters sex drive without pathologizing various expressions of libido and sexual attraction.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, that's the sort of, right, these conversations always end up in, or I don't know, you know, it's interesting, right? You see all sorts of varying reactions. You talk to enough trans people, you find all sorts of, you know, complicated ways people feel about this. Right. And then there's obviously the other side of things where it's, you know, trans guys take testosterone and then start talking about like, oh my God, you know, my sex drive is through the roof, or there's all sorts of like, you know, there's like a kind of joke people talk about, like tea makes you gay because tons of trans guys, you know, will sort of say that they never sort of felt attraction to men before, and then they start taking tea and all of a sudden they're attracted to men. But you know, I mean, like, right, when we're talking about sort of like humans, this is like so many so much more complicated, because you have obviously, right, this, you know, sort of like hormonal shift in what the predominant circulating hormone is, or gonadal hormone is. Right, obviously there's all sorts of hormones circulating, but the we're also talking about, you know, sort of like, right, for a lot of, you know, trans people, the decision to go on hormones is kind of like a like an existential one, right? Like related to how they're sort of thinking about their place in the world, what they're kind of planning on doing, how they're making meaning, how they're sort of relating to other people. And so obviously, you know, sort of experiencing a big shift in that is going to sort of, you know, be the kind of opportunity for really profound changes in self-identification and susceptibility, or susceptibility behavior is such a weird way to do it. Like behavioral, you know what I mean? Like behavior,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's just, I don't know, it's, I always find this really kind of, you know, complicated to think about the kind of, right, because you're living your own life, you're thinking about your own decisions, you're experiencing your own decisions, and you're thinking like, oh no, you know, I have sorts of reasons for this, I have, you know, all these sorts of things, and a friend told me this story the other day about, this isn't hormones, but this friend was talking about, when he was younger, he had pica, right? You know, the sort of like eating disorder where you're eating a bunch of stuff that aren't food. He was eating, like, I think sort of like picking his own skin and then eating it. And I think also ice, he said, was another thing that he was eating, and he sort of at the time didn't really sort of understand why other people thought this was like a problem. He was just kind of like, oh no, this is just like how I am, like it's fine, it's not hurting anyone, it's not hurting myself, all these sorts of things. But you know, eventually someone in his life got him on iron supplements, and then he said it was just suddenly very obvious to me that that stuff wasn't food and I shouldn't eat it. Right, but so it's kind of I guess reckoning with the way that our motivations maybe and our behavior is kind of conditioned by chemical, molecular, all these sorts of things that go into our body is, I don't know, it's a really tough question. I don't really know how to exactly think about it. I don't know if you have a general kind of framework. I mean, I guess, right, the sort of rat story we were talking about demonstrates a little bit of it, but it seems like still such a hard sort of thing to kind of sum up. Or
yeah, I mean, you're getting into this idea of like the almost like an idea of like, is there free will, right? Like this idea of biological determinism versus like not deterministic frameworks, right? And I think you know, I think that's something that like I personally and many scientists wrestle with daily, except if you're what's his face? He just published a book called Determined or something like that. And it's all about biological determinism. I can't wait to read it. Robert Sapolsky.
That's fascinating. Is he just like a hardcore?
No, he's actually like, it's a provocative title for what I understand is a very advanced book. So, I mean, it's like freaking massive. So, I mean, we'll see how that goes. If I get around to reading it, actually. but like to me, right? Like the way that I kind of like to think about it, right? Is that like, okay, if the time comes where I, as a scientist or as a person or whatever, know everything. I know where every molecule is in the brain and what every cell has done and what every minute experiences have happened to a person that has caused changes in their physiology or brain structure or brain responses or everything. Like, could I theoretically know exactly what a person is going to do? Sure. Is that possible to ever know that? And I kind of think the answer is no, right? There's just so much random chance. Like a kid could like swallow a fly, and because his mother blew in his ear when he was a child, now that fly is like a traumatic experience for him. And the other little child who did swallow the same fly didn't have, you know what I, you see what I mean? Like there's just right. There's like so much that goes into all of this that like, I think my kind of framework is that that I've kind of taken, and this is kind of going back to like the idea of like why people would take hormones and like why people make the decisions that they do in general, maybe with respect to gender expression, is like the way I keep coming back to is like, just don't lie to, like, I'm just not going to lie to myself. Right. So like, for instance, right, like I told you at the beginning that like, I don't feel very strongly one way or another, but I also dress fairly, you know, I waffle between like androgynous and like feminine, right? And when I make those decisions have been informed by my previous experiences and my knowledge of expectations of how I'm supposed to perform. And so, you know, It always kills me when like someone's like, no, you're doing it because you want to. And I'm like, yeah, but like what drove that want?
Right. Why like, do I want these things?
Right. Why do I want to? And that to me is the confluence of like my past experiences, the current social structure, and the hormones in my body all together make that want happen. And to not recognize that all of those things are there and it's not just some innate want to me has been very useful, a very useful framework for me to kind of follow, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And then there's, right. I mean, and there's just sort of, I mean, right. With respect to kind of, I guess like the question of like information and the sort of right, there's sort of I'm thinking about what you're talking about with you know, could we sort of like you know, like Maxwell's demon? Everything?
Yeah.
Well, or like you know, right, like the idea of like Maxwell's demon or something like that, right? Am I, is this the right thought experiment? Am I remembering this?
I don't
right?
actually know what you're referring to. So if you have to explain for me and the yes. viewers, it would be great.
I will. Okay, wait, no, this is a wrong. This is a wrong. Who, wait, then which? Fuck. Okay, this is a wrong. This is not the thing that I thought it was. There was some. Oh, God. There was, it's, okay. So, well, someone else used a demon in this. There's two thought experiments in the history of, I guess, physics, right? About a demon. Maxwell's demon was a demon sorting high energy molecules from low energy molecules into two separate like boxes, and that you would be generating energy out of nothing essentially if you had a demon that could do this. The demon that I'm thinking of, right, is basically just kind of like a molecular determinism idea, right? That like if you could, you know all this sorts of stuff. But when we're talking about a sort of like, or even just talking about like one person, right, like the scale of information is really crazy. And then when you consider that all that information is not just running on its own sort of like, is not just influenced by the internal system, but is also influenced by the external system or like the external system that that's a part of, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I, for like, you know, social reasons, no longer have gonads. And so like, you know, like that has really profoundly affected my body, right? You know, now I am reliant on a whole, you know, structure of someone somewhere that's farming soybeans to make, you know, soybean oil that then becomes, you know, a cheap source of like hydrocarbons that then I don't even know where the I don't know where the factory is that makes my estrogen somewhere, right? And then there's, you know, when we start talking about this is now, you know, I have to get, you know, authorized by a doctor every however many months to sort of receive that prescription, and if for some reason I'm not able to do that, you know, then I'll, you know, probably experience a whole bunch of unpleasant symptoms from not really having a ton of gonadal hormones in my body, which, you know, right? Like we said, they have all these sorts of, like you're saying about them doing, you know, double duty, the kind of sex effects of estrogen and testosterone are the ones that people talk about the most, but they have all sorts of effects that are not really like right, they're necessary for bone health.
One of my favorite quotes from Anne Fausto Sterling is like, if we didn't know about gender, sex hormones might have just been called growth hormones. And that, like, I remember reading that for the first time and being like, oh my God, you're right. Right? Like it happens during puberty. Yeah. They come on and they like make you grow from like child to adult in our current conceptions of what that means. And like you said, it's like so important for bone health. Like when you don't have those hormones, you like get premature osteoporosis, like and a whole bunch of other things that are really important for just like general body function. Because, you know, the body is lazy, right? It's like, oh, I can use this hormone for another thing. It's here. And linking it is either not a problem or advantageous. Like linking it to these other things is either not a problem or advantageous. So we're gonna go with it.
Right. No, I mean, that's, yeah, it's advantageous, I think, is like an important thing to remember, right? You know, sort of developing a whole another like system of, you know, chemical signaling is, you know, biologically difficult. Like that takes, you know, time, and it's additional resources on like a kind of, you know, caloric sense or something. I am curious actually about like what some of those other sorts of effects are, because like I said, you know, people get so, and I think this, you know, I don't actually know why this is, but people do really focus on like the most obvious kind of effects of these hormones, in the sense of sex differentiation and stuff like that. But what else do they do, right? Bones are the one that people always talk about. I think in part, part of that seems to me to certainly be, I mean, one, I guess that osteoporosis is something that you see with menopause, right? But also, you know, transphobes like to sort of, what's the word for it? Like a concern troll about, right, osteoporosis.
Yeah.
With, I guess, both like GnRH agonists used as puberty blockers, and then also just like, I don't know, any chance they get.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, there are, like, you name a function, gonadal hormones, testosterone, estradiol, progesterone probably have had some sort of function in some way, shape, or form, right? Does that mean that they are necessary for proper function? No. But does that mean they affect it? Yeah. So, you know, ones that come immediately to mind, right, are, you know, maybe something that is standard, but maybe people forget about, right, is that, like, androgens are important for, like, muscular health and muscular development. You've got estrogens being shown to be really important for let's rephrase that word. Let's say that can have large effects on memory. We also see effects of all these hormones on anxiety symptoms, depression symptoms. We see effects of these hormones on eating behavior. we see, and I just want to point out that just because we've seen this effect in one sample doesn't mean it's in all samples. And just because we've seen it in some organisms doesn't mean it's in all organisms, right? And so, for right. instance, like, my work in grad school was looking at, like, how a certain part of the brain responded to, so mice don't have a menstrual cycle, they have an estrous cycle. The bare bones difference in that is that in the menstrual cycle, there's a menstruation of the uterine lining, it comes out, and in an estrous cycle, it's like reabsorbed. So, like, that's why, like, technically dogs have a estrous cycle, not a menstrual cycle, even though sometimes they bleed, that's not actually menstruation. It's, like, not menses.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Anywho, so, like, the estrous cycle in mice, seeing how a part of the brain that is influences feeding looks at what's going on reproductively by tracking the estrous cycle, and what's going on in the body in other ways by looking at how much fat is available in the body to help influence how much the mouse is eating, right? And so I say this, right, because, like, you know, these things are linked, but that doesn't mean they will, like, I'm not going to say, like, you're going to take estradiol and you're going to, like, decrease your eating behavior, because it was also dependent on how much fat you had if you were a mouse, right? And so this right. is what I mean with how all of these things are contextual, right? And right. so I mean, that isn't an exhaustive list, what I gave you, but, you know, we've also seen, for instance, effects of these hormones on immune function, right? Neurodegeneration, like, various disease incidences, like, there's a lot these things can affect, but not necessarily determine, right, as we've been talking about.
Right, and I mean, like, in a lot of these cases, right, there's also, you know, sort of, like, the possibility, at least, of impinging social impingement on these sorts of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know so many trans girls who developed eating disorders, not, you know, sort of like or sort of like close in time to when they started hormones. And
mm-hmm.
I would probably, you know, sort of put way more weight, just kind of explanatorily, on like social pressures around womanhood mm-hmm. and desirability and all those sorts of things mm-hmm. Before I would sort of say, like, oh no, it's the hormone causing it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe mm-hmm. there is, you know, some contribution of the hormone to it, but it definitely doesn't sort of, like, follow that there's any kind of, like, deterministic relationship between the two. And
right, because if there was, then everybody who got put on E would automatically get an eating disorder, right? Which is also right. case.
Yeah, it does not happen, you know. Right. Or there's even, you know, there have also been, right, like, I know some girls who, when they started, you know, estrogen, also sort of, like, stopped eating in a disordered way.
Right.
And that, all sorts of reasons you could, I think it's, right, it's so difficult with biology, I think, especially with folk biology. People are always kind of going for just so explanations where... Like, yeah, you know, maybe that there could be, you know, there's nothing in those mechanisms that doesn't, you know, sort of have some kind of basis in reality. But it's also, you know, there's so many other mechanisms that go into it that it seems kind of silly to say, oh, this is the thing, you know?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that goes on there, in my opinion, about like these... The yearn to have a mechanistic explanation means something that is undesirable can be fixed, which is great when it's like a headache and bad when it's like a social non-desirability, right?
Right.
And then there's also the idea that, like, you know, science, even in our current state where there is a lot of mistrust in science, science still reigns supreme in terms of knowledge production, right? Like, no one is stopping telling their kids to major in STEM. You know what I mean? They still, like, and so there's this idea in my, like, you know, it's one of the things I talk about with my students, right? This, like, authority of science to tell us why things are gives us some kind of comfort because we like explanations as humans, right?
Right.
And, like, that's natural, in my opinion, to just, like, obviously you want to know why. That's why one of the most annoying questions kids ask is why, because they just want to know why for everything. And we should, that's great. We should tell them why when we can, right? Like, don't stop telling your kids why. But, like, yeah, it's just, when you can't get that why, that cognitive dissonance, it feels uncomfortable, right? And so if you find this just so explanation, you can, like, sit comfortably in that knowledge, you know?
Right. And, you know, we're talking about... Right. Well, and we're talking about these just so explanations. We're talking about... Sorry, I lost the word that I was going to, but we're talking about these just so explanations, and that reminds me of something that was in the paper, which, again, down in the episode description, the paper that you wrote along with Krisha Aghi and MJ Hill about, the paper is called Deconstructing Sex, Strategies for Undoing Binary Thinking in Neuroendocrinology and Behavior. But something that I thought was really interesting in it was the section where you discussed you discussed a recently developed sort of source I don't want to sort of speak categorically, but it seems right. So you discussed that I think it was in 2016, the NIH put on a requirement on certain funding grants that the research have some sort of discussion of sex difference with respect to the research topic. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'll just give a quick background if that's okay.
Yeah, please do.
It's called Sex as a Biological Variable. You might see it abbreviated as SABV. And it kind of grew out of this knowledge that I think it was in like 1993, you know, people were like, oh, you know, maybe we shouldn't, like, exclude women from our clinical trials, right? So they were like, okay, let's make sure that we have, you know, I don't remember how they specifically referred to it, but, like, in my opinion, it's like a gender sex, like a conflagration of those two terms, like representation in our clinical trials. And then in 2009, I believe, there was a paper that came out that was like, okay, well, we quote unquote fixed it in clinical trials. Let's look at preclinical and basic biomedical research. Like, let's look at the cells that we're using in a dish. Let's look at the animals we're using. And they found basically that aside from a few fields, like predictably, like reproduction and behavior, there was a huge, what they called male or androcentric bias, which is funny, that equation of those words, in most of the science fields, right? And so kind of in response to that, and derivative from that paper, maybe it was published in 2011, but the analysis took place in 2009. Anyway, 2015, NIH says, okay, 2016, we're going to have this, stipulation that in your grants, if you're going to get money from us, you need to consider sex as a biological variable. And what that means is that you either need to include males and females, and this is their language, right? You need to include males and females at equal levels and look to see if there's a sex difference in your output, or you need to have preliminary data that shows that there is no sex difference. And so you're just going to include males and females at the same levels, but you're not going to look for a sex difference in your output. Or you better have a, you know, in my opinion, they were scolding us. Like, you better have a damn good reason why you're only using a certain sex, right? And so obviously for something like, if you're studying like testicular cancer, you're only going to want to use animals that have testes, right? Which the NIH would claim are male. But there are other times where this could happen too, right? In the case where there's like a cell line, cell lines are, immortalized cells that we've changed to be basically immortal and they live in a dish. And you know, in those cases, the sex is a little hard to determine because usually people would say, oh, well, in this case, sex would be XX or XY. But when you change a cell to be immortal, a lot of stuff changes to the point where all of a sudden now there's like three X chromosomes and half a Y or something weird like that, right? So there are some times where you can't determine sex. And the NIH is like, okay, if you can't determine sex or you're studying a sex-specific phenomenon, that's fine. Everybody else needs to consider it. And so that's kind of the history of it. Since then, a paper came out in like 2020 showing that like the needle has moved in some ways and not in others. And more papers have shown that even though people think they're doing SABV, they're not doing it properly, whatever properly means, like for statistical analyses and stuff. So this is kind of where we are in science right now, right? Where we have this this mandate. I think it is actually called a mandate that we have to consider sex as a biological variable. And this is one of the things, as you are mentioning probably in the paper, that we are kind of trying to push back a little bit upon the logics that got us that mandate.
Right, because it was so interesting the way that you guys discussed it in the paper. And then there was some stuff, there were like some lines, like I was thinking about, there's a line in the paper, sex is not a mechanism, right? Because, which is so sort of germane, true, and it's sort of, you know, something I was thinking about in that big long spiel you were just going through about the,
sorry.
Because what sort of happens, right, is you see, you know, you can look at, you know, your population that you studied and say like, okay, well, you know, we've noticed these sorts of differences in the males versus the females, but that doesn't tell you anything about where those differences are actually coming from, right? It might be, you know, sort of like linked to, you know, hormone levels or something. It might be linked to like body composition, like percentage of fat versus muscle, or I don't know. I assume that there's any number of, you know, sort of potential variables that I'm not even thinking about because I'm not a biologist. I'm just some person.
Well, but, you know, I just want to put in defense of SABV, right? I think, you know, because I've gotten into arguments with other scientists about this, and I just want to be very clear that, like, the intention of SABV is different than its implementation.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Yeah. No,
and so, like, SABV is addressing to find the mechanism, right? They're like, if there's a sex difference, we want you to go in and see what's doing it, because sex is, they have put it, maybe not in their original mandate, but they have put it out there. Like, sex is multidimensional. We need to treat it as such. Like, sex difference is the starting point type of thing, right? But that's not outside of my specific field, right? Neuroendocrinologists, obviously, we want to know what the hormones are doing, right? Sex differences researchers who specifically focus on that, obviously, they want to find the mechanism, right? But the other people who are just doing this because of the mandate are not thinking about those mechanisms. They're like, okay, here's the sex difference, let's move on. Mm-hmm. Or there's no sex difference, let's move on.
Right. And the sort of upshot of that, the way that it then sort of gets circulated, can, you know, who knows what that can be? But I mean, like, the sort of, it seems reasonable to assume that a lot of the kind of default, like, social pressures in our world are towards what I would, you know, sort of say is like a kind of, like a biological essentialism, or like a sort of, you know, it does seem to be like the tendency is towards reduction, or like sort of like losing out on nuance. And so I'm sure that, you know, you do see sort of like not necessarily well-supported science circulating as a result of, you know, like, oh, we saw, you know, some sort of statistically significant difference according to sex, but, you know, what is it about sex that we're getting there, you know? As you said, you know, sort of like we can think about it multidimensionally. Or we, you know, it's beneficial to think about it multidimensionally, right? That is more, you know, specific and, you know, like, obviously, right? Someone who, you know, sort of like myself, right, lives in the kind of like, right? I don't really fit into, you know, I'm like, right? I don't fit into the kind of mold of, or, for a lot of this stuff, right? You know, like, it's
wait, you mean being on E hasn't made you like a femme girl? Like, what?
No, right? Well, not even necessarily that, but like, right, like, I don't have gonads, right? So it's like, right, you know, right, what right. are my sort of, you know, like, if I, you know, get arrested, right, in my state, I, you know, my state, like, my driver's license says F on it. That is actually like kind of a thing that is now like a little sort of like legally testy. My state did technically pass a law saying that, you know, sort of the gender marker on your driver's license is supposed to match the gender marker on your birth certificate as it was originally issued. And I haven't updated my birth certificate yet. If I was born in the state that I currently live in, I wouldn't be allowed to update my birth certificate at all.
I have two thoughts before I lose my mind. I just want to let you know you should read Sex Is As Sex Does by Paisley Curra.
I actually have read part of it. I need to finish the rest of it. And then actually, I was meaning to reach out to Paisley about coming on the show.
Oh my God, I'd listen so much to that.
Continue.
So I just want to plug that book for you and your listeners, but you don't need it clearly. But also, this idea of like sex should be studied multidimensionally. I want to plug a paper that just came out also from one of my co-authors, Krisha Agi. I can give it to you for the, you know, the notes, about like ways to study multidimensional sex, right? Like how do we do it, right? Because it is scary. Like, take a scientist who's been like studying males and females and like just doing like a t-test, you know, or like a basic two-way ANOVA for those like statsy among us, right? And say, okay, we need you to do like a multidimensional like linear regression. They're gonna be like, what the hell? No, I'm not doing that, right? Like, so how do we do it, right? Like, how do we do the good science? So I'll send that to you.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. I'd love to see that. And yeah, I'll put the link for both of those down in the description. And also, this is good that I'm actually saying the thing about Paisley Curra, because I literally, it was like months ago that I started reading that book. And then it fell off my radar. And now I'm like, oh, yeah, wait, I said, because I have a friend that knows Paisley. So it's I do really want to get him on the show. And I would really love to talk about that book some, because yeah, awesome. It's so fascinating. But right, I mean, I guess like, right, I mean, like, there's obviously, right, like I was talking about, you know, like what kind of prison would I end up in if I were, or jail or any sort of thing, if I were to, you know, get arrested for something. That's obviously like a sort of social question, but there are, you know, sort of like questions about accessing this, you know, hormone that we've said, you know, is important to my health, in that kind of context, which is like a social question. But then also, right, sometimes I get scared about like, oh, you know, what if I, you know, I'm in some sort of accident and get, you know, taken to the hospital, You know, I have friends who have had you know, sort of gender affirming surgeries that mean that their, you know, genitals are not the ones that they were born with, or what have you, that have had pretty like terrible experiences in hospitals as a result of doctors just not listening to them. It's like really sort of like it's really sort of terrible, you know. And so it seems like, you know, right, it's kind of, I don't know, it's a little strange, you know, sort of like living in this kind of having to live a life where you're, you know, sort of aware of the fact that, like, you know, what is the kind of how does all this science, you know, sort of like relate to my body? You know, I mean, I'm talking about stuff that, you know, doesn't really necessarily impinge on research or something like that. But like, I don't know, yeah. You know, like there was a sort of period where it looked like I had interstitial cystitis, and I don't actually, mm-hmm. which is, you know, good. But I was sort of, you know, trying to find research on that. And, you know, there's a decent amount of research into, you know, sort of sex difference on that, because, right, it's a condition of the bladder, and so there's, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. Like variable, what's the word for it, right, like, you know, having different, you know, urethra length and shape is going to sort of affect that, but there's, you know, not really any kind of research or any kind of, you know, way to even sort of approach thinking about, like, okay, well, what if you've, you know, had a vaginoplasty, and so you're, mm-hmm. you know, I don't know.
Well, first off, I'm going to say almost IC buddies. There was also a time that I was at one point pseudo-diagnosed with IC. So IC buddies, or almost IC buddies.
Yes.
But, you know, it's interesting. As you were talking, it made me think about one of the other things that my co-authors and I talk about in the paper, which is that the idea. So, like, you know, I think you touched on a little bit of, like, the problems with medicalizing these things, right? The fact that you might not have access when you need to because we've medicalized it, right? But also it provides an avenue to get these things, right? But it also, like, the idea that, like, what does it mean if you've had a vaginoplasty for certain diseases, right? Reminds me of something we talked about, which was the idea that, like, we only know, for instance, going back to gonadal hormones, really, in most cases, what gonadal hormones do in their aligned sex and gender organisms, for lack of a better way of saying it. So, like, for instance, like, when we study estrogen, we study it in quote-unquote females. And when we study testosterone, we study it in quote-unquote males, even though we know that all animals that have these hormones have all of them, just in different levels, right? And so then the question, so then when you do study cross-sex hormones, as the field puts it, it becomes like a special interest issue. It becomes a trans issue instead of it being like literally everybody has these hormones. We should figure out what they're doing in everybody in all the contexts.
Okay. I didn't realize that wasn't something that got researched. Or that wasn't, yeah, that, I mean, that was like a research gap. That's really actually surprising. I would expect people to have looked into that by now.
Yeah, I mean, there's also another paper that came out. Again, Krisha was one of the lead authors. Another one of my friends, Eartha Gutman, was the last author, talking about, like, models for gender-affirming hormone therapy. And I think that that's, like, so important. And I also think that literally just, like, studying hormones across all the contexts is also important without it necessarily having to be gender-affirming hormone therapy, which is, of course, necessary research as well.
Right. Yeah, no, there's so many different, like, ranges of human behavior that sort of affect this. And it seems, right, you know, like, incredibly germane that it, you know, would be really good to have this kind of knowledge. Right. And I mean, even in the absence of sort of like, you know, of this kind of, I mean, there exists, right, you know, some degree of, like, folk knowledge about this sort of stuff. Right. Because, you know, people are just getting a hold of this stuff, mm-hmm. like, one way or the other. And they're using it, you know, there's, like, all sorts of, you know, people that would still identify as, you know, some sort of, like, cis women that, you know, take testosterone for a variety mm-hmm. of reasons, you know, whether they're bodybuilders or, you know, they want a bigger clitoris or all sorts of things, you know? Yeah, there's, you know, cis men that take estrogen for, do bodybuilders still do that? I forget. I feel like I was told at some point that bodybuilders did that for some reason, but that might be false. I know that bodybuilders, what was that?
I have no idea.
I know I have heard that sometimes bodybuilders will take selective estrogen receptor modulators, but I don't know.
Right.
I don't know how often they do. I mean, I don't know.
That makes more sense to me than taking straight E because SERMs have like a lot of, like you would want a specific effect.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the estrogen thing was maybe like an older thing. Like they used, like a long time ago, some of them might have done that. But I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure. I might be misremembering.
Well, I want it to be true, so let's pretend it's true.
Okay, that is cool. It is a cool idea, right?
Right, and you have people who have like different forms of cancer taking anti-estrogens and anti-androgens for various reasons, right?
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Don't people with prostate cancer sometimes take estrogen? Is that a thing that I don't?
You're out of my wheelhouse. I don't know.
Okay, I have no idea. I feel like I've heard about it. I don't know. Another thing that incidentally, right, when I was going through the whole IC debacle, there was like a question about like my prostate and trying to figure out like what HRT does to your prostate is like, there's like some things that are like, it makes it bigger. Some things it makes it smaller. And it's like, okay, so it's maybe bigger or smaller and maybe related to the, I don't fucking know, you know?
maybe we should just take a look, right? You know what I mean? Like maybe, right? Like, because if the data is unclear, to me, that also means that it does affect the prostate just in different ways based on different things, right? And so like, you know, I think, back to your just so explanations, right? We want there to be an easy way that you can just look at a person and do precision medicine. But unfortunately, the more and more we learn, the more and more we realize that that's not going to be the case.
Right. Yeah. No, it's, like anyone that has had to go through a process of like having, you know, some like health problems that aren't, you know, immediately and like easily diagnosed is going to recognize like, this fucking sucks. Like, it's really scary. You know, I've been watching House again lately it's so terrible. right? But it is like, damn, I wish that, you know, a doctor cared that much.
That's so real. It's like propaganda, but for doctors.
Yeah. Oh my god. Oh my goodness. Well, we've been going for about an hour. Before I close, I was advised by a friend to ask you this. It's a good question. Are there any developments in your field that you're like excited about, or I don't know, like what do you think is cool in neuroendocrinology that you think people should know about?
At the risk of tooting my own horn a little bit, I think that the paper that, you know, started this whole conversation and everything is part of like a growing body of literature, specifically from neuroendocrinologists that are beginning to question the schemas that we're working within, particularly with regards to sex and gender and things like that. And that, to me, is really exciting. You know, these conversations are being had at, you know, national and international conferences, and yeah, it's slow going, and yeah, it's specific to like my little corner of the world and corner of the field, but it's still happening. And that to me is like really, really exciting that these conversations are moving out of like, let's say the STS space, that's science and technology studies, or like the feminist space, right? Or the philosophy of science space, and moving into science, into the lab, right? And I think that's really exciting. But like research wise, I do think, I think so. shout out to my, what I would consider my home society, which is the Society for Behavioral Neuroendocrinology. Every time I go to those meetings or read papers from those folks, I learn something really exciting and new. Whether it's about like different development of quote unquote sex chromosomes in different species or our species, or different ways that hormones interact with other things to affect behavior. So, I mean, I don't have a particularly line of inquiry that I think is like super exciting, because I'm just so nerded out by all of it. And I think it's all so cool, what, you know, the social responsibility that scientists in my field, particularly young scientists in my field, have started taking and applying it to all of these canonical and really important knowledges that we already know. I'm just so excited to see where my field goes.
That's awesome. That's really cool. And yeah, I'm, you know, my sort of background is like loosely philosophy of science. Mm. I don't know why I said loosely. I have a master's degree in philosophy, where I did study like philosophy of science and stuff like that. And I'm reminded of, I forget who said it once, but there was he meant this as like a dig at philosophy of science, which is the relevance of philosophy of science to scientists is like the relevance of ornithology to birds. Or the usefulness of ornithology to birds, I should say. Which someone was like, well, if the birds could understand ornithology, it would probably actually be pretty useful for them, right?
Yeah.
So it's good that it is, you know, refreshing to see that scientists have started taking interest in that. That's actually really refreshing to hear. As someone sort of outside the field, I feel like sometimes stuff only comes up when it's like, you know, like bad news travels a lot farther than good news. So it's great to hear that there are a lot of people taking up social responsibility with respect to this sort of stuff, and that I don't know. Hopefully that's good tidings.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope we can keep the momentum going.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and, you know, teaching me some stuff. I hope teaching the audience some stuff. I'm sure that many people are going to learn many things from this. So I really appreciate that. And thank you to the audience for listening. Thank you to everyone that supports the podcast on Patreon, and that, you know, has said, just everyone that's engaged with the podcast or, you know, shared it with friends or any of that sort of stuff really does mean the world to me.
Thank you so much for having me. Thanks for listening to my rambles. I mean, I did warn you that I was a professor, right? So I like to hear myself talk.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much. And I hope that, you know, if you have any other questions or anything, feel free to hit me up.
Yeah, absolutely. If I like come across something you're gonna regret that offer.
No, I'm really not. This has been too much fun for me to regret that offer.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. That means a lot.